Proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live. Today, actually, we're in San Diego. We're not doing any public appearances or anything. We just have some business in town. But special tip of the hat and thanks to KLSD for offering us a studio to do the show from. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for our blog. And as always, the first hour of our Friday program, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. I think of him as America's senator. He's not a Democrat, not a Republican. And Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Or welcome to your program, our Brunch with Bernie show.
Let me just say a word before we get into content here, Tom. I want to applaud you again, as I have in the past. Clearly, one of the major problems in our country is a media controlled by big money interests, which either gives us a right-wing slant or attempts to deflect attention away from the real issues facing working families in the middle class of this country. And you and a handful of other progressive talk show hosts have played just an extraordinarily important role in trying to open up dialogue in this country so that different perspectives are heard, especially perspectives that impact working families. So congratulations to what you're doing.
Thank you, Bernie. It's the most fun thing I can think of to do, and changing the world in a positive way is, you know, I know that's your motivation for being in Congress, too. So anyhow, both our arms will get sore from patting each other on the back if we don't stop now. Here I am stuttering, sorry. We have some friends who are actually thinking of retiring to Costa Rica, and you just came back from Costa Rica.
Right.
I'm curious to, A, tell me about the country, and B, tell me about what's the deal with the trade agreements.
Well, let me spend a minute on this. And the reason that I was there is that on October 7th, in a week or so, Costa Rica is going to be having the very first public referendum on a free trade agreement that has ever been held. And the question is whether or not they will join CAFTA. And what is absolutely phenomenal is in Costa Rica, you have a strong ruling class. You have a media very much aligned with the ruling class. You have huge amounts of money coming in from big money interest in the United States and in Costa Rica to urge people to pass this agreement. In fact, if you can believe this, Tom, what I'm told is the discrepancy is 100-1. That
wow.
For every dollar the anti-CAFTA people are spending, $100 is being spent. The American ambassador in Costa Rica is going around the country doing something that is absolutely outrageous, but in fact pushing this agreement. And the latest poll, despite all of that, because of a very strong grassroots opposition from trade unions, from students, from environmental groups, from religious groups, the last poll has the election tied and the momentum swinging to the nose.
Wow.
And this is a 100-1 discrepancy in spending, government there, all for it, and so forth and so on. And it's something, while Costa Rica is a very small country, 3 or 4 million people, one of the very few countries in the world where, as they reminded me, there are more Americans moving and visiting Costa Rica than Costa Ricans coming into the United States.
Yeah. They're also, I think, the only country in this hemisphere that has no army.
That's right. Absolutely. They had a terrible civil war in the late 40s. They abolished the army. They have made significant gains in health care. They have a national health care program. They have free college education. They have quite a good educational system, almost no illiteracy at all. So they have accomplished a whole lot. And there is the fear, a fear on the part of many, many people who are opposing this agreement that opening the doors wide open to American corporate interests will have a very negative impact on the cost of medicine. It may lead to the destruction of their telecommunications program, there, which is publicly owned. They, for cell phone service in Costa Rica now, they're paying $7 or $8 a month. How's that?
Wow.
And they're worried now on the public ownership that, you know, once you open this thing up, you'll have people like Carlos Slim from Mexico, who's big into telecommunications.
And now the richest man in the world.
From a country like Mexico. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Can you believe that? And that's certainly, all right. So, and they're looking at what NAFTA has done to Mexico and the destruction of
right.
Of
it built the oligarchy, actually.
Exactly. So this is, it's a very interesting issue down there. I was there because there are the leadership there and the strong proponents of the yes vote are lying about what the United States government were doing. They're saying, well, if we vote no, then the United States will cease having a good relationship with Costa Rica. The United States will force Costa Rica out of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, which is important to them. So I was down there saying, hey, this is nonsense. This is not the case. You're a democratic country. You vote the way you want, and you're not going to be punished for exercising your democratic rights. So it was, but what you saw down there was just the power of money in pushing through this neoconservative agenda of extreme free trade, unfettered free trade, and the repercussions of that.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. And that's going to be an interesting one to keep an eye on. Do you know when they're going to have their vote?
Yeah, it'll be on October 7th.
October 7th. Okay,
it's going to be a very, very close vote.
We'll have to keep track of that. In the U.S. Senate, the senators now and the House day before yesterday had plenty of time to condemn MoveOn.org. Nobody was speaking out about condemning the Swift Vote veterans. Nobody was.
Well, some were, as a matter of fact. In all fairness, Harry Reid got up there and made exactly that point, as did, I think, Barbara Boxer.
Yeah.
And I was in a committee, otherwise I would have been down on the point. I mean, I think it's just outrageous. It is whether you could think it's a good, I don't think it's the smartest ad that anyone ever ran, to be honest with you. But the point is, yeah, every day there are editorials, every day there are ads, and as you point out, the ads against Max Cleland,
right,
former senator from Georgia, to suggest that a man who lost three limbs in Vietnam was not patriotic, the ads against Senator Kerry. I mean, there's a lot of horrendous stuff being done in America, and the function of the United States Senate is not to be condemning organizations that run ads, whether you like it or you don't like
right.
it. And I think it was a real slap.
So, so how did Harry Reid let that get to the floor, or was it attached to something that he couldn't control?
To the best of my knowledge, he couldn't stop it. The Republicans have a right to offer a certain number of amendments, and this was one of the amendments that they offered on the whole war issue, as I recall.
So this is an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill.
I believe that is exactly right.
I see.
So it was, they had the right to offer it, but I was disappointed at the number of Democrats and Republicans. Frankly, it's an attack on free speech.
Mm.
Very political effort. I think Move On, you know, they're far from perfect. I don't know any perfect organization, but they're doing a really, really good job, and they did not need to be slapped around by the United States Senate. So that was, I think, not a great day for the Senate. On the other hand, what was a better day is yesterday we passed in the Senate, just as the House had, a significant expansion in the children's health insurance program that would add another 4 million children into the SCHIR program, which is a program providing health insurance to low and moderate income kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a president, I mean, when you look at where this president is coming from, and as I've said many times, I think history will record him as perhaps the worst president this country has ever had. Not only is he intending to veto this legislation, they had 4 million more kids to health insurance, he wants to go a step further and throw kids in this country off of health insurance because a family perhaps that's making, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 he thinks is too rich to be able to take advantage of this program. And in Vermont, we have expanded the SCHIP program. Middle class families are taking advantage of it. They need it. They are benefiting from it. And that's true all over the country. And Bush wants to not only stop an expansion of the program, but deny middle-class families the opportunity. He clearly is, his function here is to represent the insurance industry. He's very upset that they will lose some profits by not providing for these kids, even in cases where the families can't afford it. I think we have enough votes to override him in the Senate. There is a fear that we don't have enough votes to override him in the House, but it totally outrageous action.
We had a caller a couple days ago who said he just turned 60, got his, you know, went down to Medicare to sign up, and they told him that he had to get a card from a private insurance company that's dealing with part of Medicare's system. Do you know about this?
The Medicare Plus program?
I don't know. He said.
Well, over the years there have been a major effort on the part of the Bush administration to privatize Medicare, to privatize Social Security, and right now what we're dealing with is these private contractors in Iraq. And we just passed a very good, we've talked about it on this program, a Truman-like commission to look at war profiteering.
Yep.
That was just passed last night in the Senate.
Oh, that's great.
We can talk about that after the break.
Good on you. Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie will be taking your calls as well, 1-866-303-2270. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on a wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
Well, unless we take this country back, unless we start changing the way business is done. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you on the Tom Harbin program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com for our blog. Hey, Bernie.
Yeah, Tom, before we go to the questions, let me just say a word about this independent commission that was just passed again last night as part of the DOD authorization bill. I think there is widespread perception that Halliburton and other corporate interests and private contractors in Iraq are ripping off the American people to the tune of many, many billions of dollars. What this commission will do is, and it's kind of replicate what the Truman Commission did in World War II. And many people have called us about that issue on this show. So I'm happy to say that that was at least passed in the Senate. We're going to fight to see that it stays in the conference committee. It is morally unacceptable for there to be massive fraud, war profiteering in Iraq, and ripping off the American people at the same time as our soldiers in a number of instances are not even getting the vehicles and the kind of equipment that they need. So that's an issue we're making some progress. And I also want to say, apropos of the song that we just heard leading into this segment, I'm a member of the Veterans Committee, and I fought, along with a number of other people, for the largest increase in VA funding that the VA has ever seen. The president was not happy with it, but he has enough political sense to know not to veto it. So you're going to see a huge increase in VA funding. One of the things which the Republicans are going to fight is that we have brought back into the system, put enough money to bring back into the system, the so-called Category 8s. These are veterans who Bush threw out of VA health care because they had incomes of over $27,000 that did not have any service-connected disability.
Right. He said if you make over $27,000, you're too rich.
But if you make billions of dollars, we can give you tax breaks. And that is the mentality that exists here.
Yeah. It's pretty tragic. Well, good on you. It's good to know that, good things are happening in the Senate. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bob in Brooklyn, New York. You are live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bob.
I know almost nothing about Medicare. I wonder if you could explain. It's my understanding that it's at least partially funded by premiums, which are deducted from a person's Social Security pension check. I'd like to know, can you tell me exactly how is Medicare funded? Is it financially solvent? Will there be increases in the future, big increases in the Medicare premiums? And what about, is there some type of surcharge on the premiums for people making a certain amount of money. Can you talk about these?
Okay. Medicare is a federal program passed in the 60s by Lyndon Johnson, who recognized that older people have greater health care needs, and many of those people had no insurance. In recent years, the Republicans and President Bush have tried to move toward a privatization of Medicare, which, while it has its share of problems, is run administratively in a pretty cost-effective way, especially compared to private insurance companies. Much less money is spent on administration in Medicare than is the case in the private sector. The Medicare costs have been soaring, as have the cost of health care in general. And sometimes people, opponents of Medicare, will point the finger and say, look what's going on, Medicare costs are soaring. Well, the truth is, because of our dysfunctional and convoluted and bureaucratic system in general, healthcare costs are soaring. So what you are seeing now are some of us strongly defending Medicare. We want to increase funding for Medicare, while at the same time as we want to make the entire healthcare system more efficient in general. On the other hand, there are those people who do not like government programs in general. They are upset that the private insurance companies are not able to get their hands on senior citizens, and they want to move toward a privatization, a privatized system. President has underfunded Medicare, which always means that there'll be a cut in services for seniors, or else seniors are going to have to pay more money. We recently passed a prescription drug bill, which I voted against because it was written by the pharmaceutical industry, making the cost of drugs for seniors much more expensive than they have to be. So that's kind of a snapshot of what's going on there.
Right. And in part, it's funded as part of the FICA, isn't it? That's
of
part
course.
That's where it's funded.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So
we all pay for it, right.
So we're all paying for it. And if the FICA cap were eliminated...
Medicare, the FICA cap has been eliminated.
Oh, it has. Okay.
But not in Social Security.
I see. Okay, great. Thank you. Is Senator Bernie Sanders with us? It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, taking your calls, 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Drop by our live chat room if you'd like, tomhartman.com. Click live chat up at the top of the page. It'll get you in there. Drop by Bernie's website. It's sanders.senate.gov. Or you can visit our blog over at airamerica.com. 27 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Much like me and you, I have a silly notion, if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
Terrible thing. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Of course, the sponsors that you hear on your local stations, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, The Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com, Purina One, 1-866-380-MEOW, and goleft.tv. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.senate.gov is his website. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. And Bernie, back to the phones?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do it here. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. Bernie, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I want to thank you for the new Truman Commission. It'll save more than the increase in VA benefits, I'm sure. But I've got a hard question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is Congress going to authorize and fund the use of foreign mercenaries inside the United States? Many of the Blackwater people are not U.S. citizens. They're foreigners. Apparently, there is a bill that authorizes the use of such mercenaries inside the U.S., to perform the disaster relief duties of the National Guard, because the Guard is stuck in Iraq. Are we going to have Ukrainian mercenaries patrolling U.S. streets? I'm just going to hang up now. Thank you. Again.
Well, thanks, Ralph.
Well, thank you very much, Ralph. Thank you for your service to the country, and that's an excellent question. And obviously, if I have anything to say about that, that will not be the case. Ralph makes the correct point that many of our national guard forces are depleted. Many states and governors are having serious problems with the National Guard in terms of manpower, in terms of loss of equipment, because of the deployments to Iraq. And that's just one of the side effects of this disastrous war in Iraq, is that many states are not prepared effectively to deal with the emergencies that may come down the pike. But to answer Ralph's question, obviously that is something that should not be happening. And this, what you are going to see with this commission, by the way, is also increased discussion about the implications, the broad implications of privatizing our military and, in fact, privatizing many other aspects of our government.
Okay. Scott in Phoenix, Arizona, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Bernie. Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
It's a real honor to be able to talk to you. I just got back from a very relaxing vacation to Vermont. In part, I chose this mention from hearing you talk about the beauty of your state.
And was I right?
Scott, your phone's breaking up.
Okay, I'm sorry. My question real quick is, one of the things I was most about...
Scott, I'm sorry. Your phone has disintegrated on us. Whenever possible, when folks call in, try and call in on a landline. It's always a better idea. Ken in Louisville, Texas. Hey, Ken, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Sure, that's Louisville, Texas.
Louisville, thank you.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, with respect to the non-binding resolution that my senator proposed and got through the Senate, I'm sorry it took up valuable time. And,
you mean against MoveOn.org?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's interesting because the Center for American Progress reported today that this week Rush Limbaugh, when talking to an active military service personnel who felt that the people on the ground weren't being asked enough about the direction in Iraq, that anyone who was against the administration was a phony soldier. So now I wonder if the Senate, in its sense of the Senate, will condemn Rush Limbaugh for this disparaging comment. And I sent this comment to both Senators Cornyn and Senator Hutchinson.
Well, I think Ken raises the right point, and whether it is a good use of Senate time when it is takes so long to get anything done here in Washington to be arguing about an ad that appeared in the New York Times put on by MoveOn or any of the brilliant comments made by Rush Limbaugh. And that is the point. I mean, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh's show every day, they're going to be an absurd remark, dishonest remarks. And if we're going to waste all of our time worrying about that or what goes on at Fox Television, you're not going to get any work done. This was an attack, it seems to me, on the constitutional rights and the freedom of expression that any group in America has, and we should not be wasting time condemning them.
Yeah, and in fact, Patrick Murphy, the Democrat from Pennsylvania and the House of Representatives yesterday, said someone should tell Chicken Hawk Rush Limbaugh that the only phony soldiers are those who choose not to serve and then criticize those who do. The only phonies, he said. Right. I served proudly. So did two of my fellow paratroopers in the 82nd Airborne who spoke out and died just weeks ago. Generations of American veterans have worn the uniform with pride, and we know it is no contradiction to serve your country and still disagree with the Bush civilian leadership that mismanaged this war.
That's what we're fighting for, isn't it?
Yeah.
For democratic rights and freedom of expression. And you know, phonies like Limbaugh who trying to intimidate people from speaking out and expressing their point of view.
Yeah, indeed. Rich in Stratford, Connecticut, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Watching the debate on Wednesday, Mike Gravel brought up the concept of actually trying to override one of the president's vetoes if they bring up an amendment to try to get us out of Iraq. And the moderator said basically that the senator shouldn't be taking time off for running for president to do such an act. And I got really upset about that, thinking that if the senators and congressmen can't take time off to run for president to do their job as a senator to get us out of this war, why should they be president? You're in the Senate with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and if they're not willing to try to overturn a presidential veto and come back from running for president to do that, why should they be president?
Each person will have to make his or her judgment on the candidates that they're going to support. I think the real issue here is the kinds of never-ending campaigns that we have, the pressure on candidates to raise incredible sums of money. I think it is not correct to say that if somebody is in the United States Senate, they can't run for president. I mean, if you're going to have to be out in California, you know what, you're going to miss some votes. And that is the way it is. And people can take that into consideration. There may be people who feel as the caller does. In terms of overriding the veto, we don't have the votes to override the veto. That's the simple reality. We don't have the votes. For those of us who want to end this war, who want to bring our troops back home, we don't have the 60 votes that we need to stop debate and stop Republican obstructionism, let alone the 67 votes, the 66 votes that we would need to override a veto. So,
but Bernie, why doesn't Harry Reid say to the Republicans, "Okay, you guys, you want to filibuster this thing? Fine, start talking. Here's a phone book."
That's a very good, Tom. I am not. I think your point is well taken. I think a lot of people don't understand that when they read about votes on the floor of the Senate, they say, "Oh, we lost the war vote." We didn't lose the war vote. That vote never took place. We lost the ability to end the debate and to have the vote. The votes that you're reading about are votes on whether or not we end debate. And what Tom Hartman is saying here, which I happen to agree with, is if we cannot end the debate, if Republicans want to continue filibustering, let them filibuster. And let them filibuster to 3 in the morning and to 5 in the morning. And let's have it. Let the American people understand and see what is happening, not only on the war, although maybe the war most importantly, but on other issues as well. What is happening right now is the Republicans have decided to play a major obstructionist role, so that on virtually every important issue, it's not 51 votes that wins, it is 60 votes that wins. And we don't have 60 votes on some very important issues. But I agree with you, Tom. I think if Republicans want to filibuster, hey, let's stay up all night and continue that discussion.
Yeah, instead of just politely saying, oh, you're going to filibuster. Okay, we'll move on.
I agree with you.
Yeah, okay. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders, Andre.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine, but I'll get better.
Good. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon, Andre.
I have a question. I've done some research, and I found that on the Republican candidates and on the Democratic side, most of the candidates, I'd say there are only three that are not affiliated or associated with the Council on Foreign Relations. And in light of the horrific foreign relations policy of this administration and our country for the last 6-7 years, how can the American people be assured that, you know, even if they vote Democratic for the top-tier candidate, that the Foreign Relations Council doesn't dictate still to them?
Well, let me just say a few words, Andre. Number one, I don't know if that number is right. I'm not affiliated with the Foreign Relations Council, and I got to believe that there are more than three others who are not. But second of all, Andre, let's not get into conspiracy theories. We have a foreign policy in this country, which I think has been an absolute and unmitigated disaster. It has managed to antagonize virtually the entire world. We are held in lower esteem than we have probably been in maybe American history. And we need to fundamentally change it. But don't think that this is occurring because there's a small cabal of people who are dictating to the United States Senate. I think what is happening is you have big money interests to a very significant degree in the military-industrial complex who have a lot of power. You have politics involved because all you have to say is that, hey, I'm fighting terrorism, vote for me, and that's often a political winner. So we got to change our foreign policy. But I don't think it helps us to get into conspiracy theories.
Yeah, to some extent, we're seeing the fulfillment of Eisenhower's warning.
Yeah.
But, yeah. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.Senate.gov. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog. Stick around.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Viagra for your brain on Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
You see, what we have to do is stand together. This is the incredible question that Michael Moore asked in his brilliant movie Sicko. Are we going to be a me society, or are we going to be a we society? Working towards a we society here on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, and Bernie Sanders in the Senate, sanders.senate.gov, his website. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. You're taking your calls. Bernie.
And Tom, I should say that Michael Moore asked the right question. United we stand, divided we fall. And that's what it's all about.
It really is. It's like when the Declaration of Independence was signed and John Hancock said, there must be no dissent. We must be absolutely united in this. We must hang together on this. And then Ben Franklin made a joke. He said, yes, we must hang together on this because if we don't, we shall certainly hang separately. And that really is what's happening, is we're hanging separately. I mean, all across the America, people...
believe me, that is exactly what these corporate interests want to do. They have all of the money, they have all of the power, and the only way to stop these guys in terms of the fight to have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people, a fair tax system, so that we take the burden off the middle class and ask the billionaires to start paying their fair share, and on, it doesn't happen unless people stand united.
Amen. David in Belleville, New Jersey, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, it's my honor to be on the phone with two great Americans.
Thank you.
My concern is Iran. Threats of Bush and the plans for Cheney to even bomb Iran with nuclear weapons. And this week, the Senate passed a resolution that would allow Bush to backdoor into Iran by declaring the Iranian National Guard a terrorist group. And I'm wondering if Senator Sanders can enlighten us.
David, thank you. That's an excellent question, and you characterized the amendment absolutely correctly. I voted against that amendment, voted against it very strongly. This amendment would, for the first time, define a part of a government, in this case the Iranian military, as a terrorist organization, which then makes the country a terrorist organization, which then opens up opportunities for Bush to be more likely to attack Iran. That is the bad news. I think that was a very bad amendment. The good news is that just the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, some of us met with the Secretary of Defense, who was circumspect about the issue, but basically let us know that as Secretary of Defense, he has strong concerns about an attack on Iran and understands what the implications of that would be. In my view, if the United States attacked Iran, essentially, you would be looking at war for your kids and your grandchildren for decades. You would be starting a never-ending asymmetric war by which people within the Islamic, terrorists within the Islamic community, or people would be fighting back in a dozen different ways, and it would be a never-ending war. So at a time when we have a war which is not going well in Iraq, we have a war which is not going well in Afghanistan, the idea of opening up a third front, if you like, and starting a war with a larger, more powerful country is just, to me, simply outrageous. So we're going to do everything we can to stop that. I have offered an amendment which would require that the president come to Congress before he attacks Iran. So that's where we are on that.
And how's that amendment doing? And what can
there is growing sentiment. I mean, I don't think that the Congress would vote to give him the authority. But you have, you know, what can I say about the gentleman who's in the White House? I think
yeah, indeed. Skip in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, gentlemen. Senator, I have a question for you, and thank you for your service on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. The veterans out here in Washington State greatly appreciate the great work that you've done.
By the way, out in Washington, you should know that Patty Murray is doing, Senator Patty Murray is doing a tremendous job on veterans issues as well.
Amen, Senator. We like to think our whole congressional delegation out here speaks with one voice when they speak about veterans. And the question I have to ask you, sir, is that the large increase, and historically, I believe that you're currently correct about the historic increase in the VA budget this year, based upon an estimate of 5.8 million veterans being enrolled in the healthcare system, has been diminished somewhat, hasn't it, sir, by a continuing resolution that, in effect, we're not going to get a budget on time. We're going to get a budget after November 6th, maybe before Thanksgiving.
Well, that's a very fair
And didn't question. We lose about $500 million in this delay? And actually, when the secretary spoke last week at the House, in his farewell address, he said that there were 7.6 million veterans enrolled and testified in writing to the House Veterans Affairs Committee about the current enrollment, which makes the estimate of the budget about $3 billion short.
Skip, you have – I'm sorry that I don't have the data in front of me. What I will tell you is, number one, I want to see this VA budget passed as soon as possible. Number two, this budget is by far the largest increase in the history of the VA. Number three, this budget deals not only with our soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with a myriad of problems. What it also does, as I mentioned earlier, is it allows what is called the Category 8s, veterans earning more than $27,000 a year who have non-service-connected disabilities, come back into the system, which I think is right. I should tell you that Republicans are very strongly opposing that provision. We're going to take it to the floor, and I hope that we win, because I think all veterans should be entitled to VA health care.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, sanders.senate.gov, the website. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Very good. My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Great talking with you, as always. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be taking your calls. It's our Anything Goes Friday, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, Larry Craig's back in the Senate voting against the hate crimes legislation that was actually passed by the Senate that would protect gays from, put gays into the category of protected folks from hate crimes. I don't know how you say that, but you understand what I mean. Larry Craig basically continuing his homophobic voting record. This is rather startling. Well, actually, it's not. I guess he's trying to reinvent himself. And Congressman Patrick Murphy on the floor of the House. This was a good one. I mean, this is Congressman Patrick Murphy speaking, the Democrat from Pennsylvania. Speaking out, I shared that with you during the time that we were talking with Senator Sanders. Congressman Frank Pallone, the Democrat from New Jersey, speaking directly on the floor of the House today. This is this morning. Again, talking about Limbaugh, talking about the phony soldiers. Here's the clip.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday House Republicans offered a motion to recommit condemning MoveOn.org for its advertisement stating that General Petraeus had betrayed us. I'm wondering if they'll show similar outrage over statements made yesterday by conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh. Yesterday, Limbaugh called service members who support a withdrawal from Iraq phony soldiers. Is Limbaugh serious? Is a soldier who is honorably serving our nation in Iraq any less a soldier if he questions what appears to be a never-ending war? Last month, seven soldiers from the U.S. Army 82nd Airborne Division wrote an op-ed in the New York Times questioning our continued war efforts, but also stating, and I quote, "We need not talk about our morale. As committed soldiers, we will see this mission through." Now, since publication of that op-ed, two of the soldiers have died. As this op-ed shows, soldiers may question the war, but that does not mean that they're any less committed to their mission. And now I wonder if Republicans who showed so much outrage towards MoveOn yesterday will hold Rush Limbaugh to the same standard. And I wouldn't hold your breath.
Yeah, we're not holding our breath here either. What it does, though, is it shows how the Republican Party, tragically, there's a reason for this, by the way, and that is that they're not where mainstream America is. The Republican Party, tragically, is taking virtually every issue that comes down the road and playing politics with it rather than playing statesmanship with it. Taking issues like the war in Iraq or, you know, this ad that MoveOn.org ran, which isn't an issue, but it's relevant to the war in Iraq. Taking these things and turning them into political gotchas rather than asking the question, what's the best thing for this country? What's the best thing for the people of the United States? What's the best thing for all life on Earth, ultimately? And frankly, I'm seeing in increasing numbers, and particularly over the last decade, I think the Bush administration has been a huge wake-up call for a lot of people. I'm seeing in increasing numbers, not just Americans, but also politicians, mostly in the Democratic Party. There are a few in the Republican Party who have been stepping out and speaking out. I've been quite impressed, frankly, for example, with Chuck Hagel lately, the guy that I've been picking on for years, who are standing up and speaking out on behalf of America and on behalf of peace in the world. You know, this radical concept whose last major proponent in the Republican Party, arguably, was Dwight Eisenhower. And so I commend the Congressman Pallone, you know, who you just heard from, Congressman Patrick Murphy, who spoke out about this. I think it's great. And I think we need to continue thinking about the larger picture there. Kevin in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi,
thanks,
Tom,
for calling.
Great show. I wanted to just mention real quickly, I took a look at on the Internet, and this is something you can look at over if you look at OPEC.org. They show quotas and allocations of everyone in OPEC. And you can see that Saudi Arabia was, of the OPEC members, benefited the most from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1990. And, you know, there have been reports that Iran...
Because it jacked up the price of oil, you mean?
I'm sorry?
The OPEC nations benefited because the one of the effects of the war in Iraq was to jack up the price of oil.
Well, but there's one nation in particular, there's one OPEC member in particular that benefited the most. There was approximately 50% increase in the quota ceiling for Saudi Arabia after the invasion. In fact, if you look at the agreement that they had August 90th to March 91, Iraq had an allocation of 3 million barrels per day, Saudi Arabia 5.38. After the invasion, Iraq 0, Saudi Arabia 8.034.
Wow. Thus, Bandar Bush going to the White House, or to the Crawford White House, to hang out with George right around the time that we invaded Iraq.
Right. And so the main thing I just wanted to point out that, and also in the context of invading Iran, of course, is another OPEC state. It has approximately the same allocation proportionally that Iraq had. And Saudi Arabia has been, there's been reports that they've had more to do with attacks on our forces and the chaos kind of that, you know, it's supposedly keeping us there than Iran has. So, you know, draw your own conclusion, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. In other words, yeah. Good point, Kevin. Thank you very much. Interesting information. Steve in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, it's Oregon Day. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Oh, this is a pleasure. Here in Eugene, we had a airport incident yesterday that was a cross between Keystone Cops and a sleep at a wheel. A 9-inch pipe looked exactly like a bomb, officials said. But TSA examined it and initially concluded it wasn't. The guy was allowed to board. It was taken from his luggage. The guy was allowed to board the plane and take off. On further scrutiny and out of an abundance of caution, local authorities were contacted, said Andre McCauley, spokesman for the TSA. Eugene police officer stationed at the airport took one look at the pipe and called in the bomb squad. The airport was closed down for hours, and...
Yeah, I caught the story, Steve. What's your point?
I was hoping to ask Bernie to get the Senate to look into it. I've already told our...
Well, Steve, I'm sorry Bernie's not here. And if there are any other callers who have questions for Bernie, call back next Friday. 1-866-303-2270, our number. And Bob in Clinton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Or Clifton, Tennessee.
I was thrilled yesterday when you made your statements about soundbite statements that you thought they were incorrect. So I hope I'll have time to challenge you on your many early statements about your being a capitalist. I don't believe you're a capitalist. A capitalist earns money with money. You're a working man. You're a worker.
Yeah, to a large extent. And in fact, every business I've started with my own money and mostly with sweat equity. But the fact of the matter is right now, Bob, I have some money that's invested in the market and for retirement. So that makes me a capitalist, I guess.
Well, I contend that we are confused in this country between free enterprise and capitalism.
I agree with you.
They are not synonymous words.
I agree with you.
Basic economics are land, labor, and capital. And ism denotes a supremacy, an ideology. So the suffix ism on capital means a supremacy of capital, turns upside down basic economics, puts capital first, labor second, and in the environment or resources on the bottom.
Yeah, no, you're quoting Mr. George. Henry George, isn't it?
Well, I'm not quoting anyone.
The economist,
I just think of this on my own. I especially liked your show earlier this week with the economics professor.
Yeah.
But I think we need to keep in mind the very basics. You know, the agricultural model tells us about land, labor, and capital. In the agricultural model, we have resources, the land, the climate, and such. We have the workers in the field that nurture the crop. That's the labor. That makes everything of value. And the capital is saving our seeds for the next year.
Well, capital is typically, in that triad, capital typically is defined as the tools, as the factory, as the mechanism, as the systems, the transportation system, and then ultimately also as the cash that allows all of that to work, that acts as a surrogate for all that stuff. But your point is well taken, Bob, and we used to understand in this country, for example, that labor and capital were distinct things and that they should have some balance. In fact, it was Abraham Lincoln, who was the president, who said labor is superior to capital because it precedes it. In other words, you don't have money until somebody makes something. We've kind of lost track of that. We don't have the labor section in the papers anymore. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday, 21 minutes past the hour. Let me just riff just a little bit more on this concept of land, labor, and capital. Because there's this video of the guy who's the president of the Henry George Society. This has kind of gone viral on YouTube, and a lot of people are talking about it. And he's right. Henry George, I think he was writing in 1890, as I recall, more or less an economist, talking about there is land, there is labor, and there are capital. These are the three things that make up an economy. And his suggestion was that we should only tax land, and we should tax it at 100% of value, and then we should give it away. So people pay 100% tax on it every year, but they get it for free. And that we should eliminate taxes on labor, and we should eliminate taxes on capital. Well, I just, you know, and the reason why, he said, was because land is the one thing that we all hold in common. It is the common property of the community, and therefore it shouldn't be ownable by individuals beyond a certain range, and the tax is giving back to the community. It's a little complex, but it's really not, you know, when you get right down to it. Where I disagree with him is I would submit that labor is also a function of the community, because we learn to be laborers. We learn, you know, how to do things. We have public education. We have a society, a public culture. We have all the infrastructure of society that allows us to grow up, to participate in society and become labor. And so I would say that labor is also part of the common wealth. I agree with Henry George that land is part of the common wealth, and I would submit that capital, to a large extent, is the consequence, again, of all that infrastructure, that not just money capital, but factories and technology and tools and all this kind of stuff, all of that comes about also as a consequence of society existing. So the question then becomes, you know, what do you tax? Thomas Jefferson wrote about this at some length. He argued that you could basically tax labor, you could income, you could tax wealth. That is, every year you say, okay, how much are you worth? What is not property? He wasn't even talking about property taxes back in that day, but the wealth tax. So every year you say, okay, you're worth X, and however you hold that, whether it's in stocks or land or you know, cash in your back pocket, whatever it may be, we're going to tax that wealth, or you tax transactions, sales taxes. And he suggested that we should pick one, and his preferred one was income, because that varied from year to year. Although he wasn't opposed to taxing wealth. We don't tax wealth in the United States. The closest we get to it is property taxes, is taxing property. But I would submit to you that the one thing that we do tax that you can't justify, if the justification for a tax is that tax is the way that we pay back all the rest of us for everything that's there. In other words, when I pay income tax, I'm paying for the police and the fire and the streets and the intellectual and all that kind of. I think you could build a good case that land is part of the commons, and therefore taxing land makes a certain amount of sense. That arguably wealth, that makes sense. Labor, taxing labor, I just made the case for it. Taxing capital, I made the case for it. But taxing transactions, sales tax, I can't build a case for that. Outside of the one exception being communities that get most of their income from tourism. And there you have people coming from outside the community, coming into the community and using the resources and not paying for the resources that they're using beyond simply buying things. And so how does, and that money then doesn't go back into the community. It's going into private hands. So you could build a case for a sales tax being a viable and intelligent and justifiable, economically and morally justifiable thing in a tourism economy. But outside of that, I don't think that you can build a case for it. It's the most regressive of all of our taxes. And so anyhow, that's my riff on that. Dave in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Two quick questions, if I can get the time. First of all, where did you get the version of Mein Kampf when you substituted liberal for Jew and Germany for USA?
The producer of this program back 5 years ago, a fellow by the name of Joe McPherson, who goes by the name Zen Pickle on the web, now lives in Korea. He's teaching English in Korea. He did that, and he did it with several different chapters, and he put it up on his website, and he called it Mein Kampf by Ann Coulter or something like that. It was some pastiche. And it is incorporated into an article that I wrote that was published on Common Dreams about 3 years ago that I don't remember the title of it, but if you go over to commondreams.org and you use Google to just search within Common Dreams and you search, quote, Tom Hartman, close quote, quote, Mein Kampf, close quote, you'll find it. It's fairly easy to find. Second question, we've got about 30 seconds before we take a break.
John Edwards, in that debate, we were kind of holding out for him being the great white hope, seeing as how I don't think Kucinich can make it, kind of flip-flopped, to my recollection, on the constant presence we're going to have and the bases in Iraq. Had you heard that before?
No, he said the exact opposite. He said that he would take all combat troops out, period. And then Hillary said, no, we got to leave some people in there to fight against Al-Qaeda. And he said, no, we don't. He said that, you know, if there's going to be a fight against Al-Qaeda, the world is going to do it, not just us. In fact, he said it would be a disaster for us to do it. So, no, I'd say I thought he was consistent, and I thought he was pretty straightforward. Dave, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270. Drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And walking, crawling, running. Here we go. We're moving along. Bill O'Reilly. I'm being smeared. He's all... Poor Bill. He was amazed to discover that African Americans in a restaurant owned and largely patronized by African Americans don't yell at each other asking for their iced tea using obscenities. He was amazed. And now he's being smeared for being amazed. Poor guy. What can you say? Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Patty in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Patty, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you. There's very little in the Bush administration that doesn't either make me terribly unhappy or terribly sad. But what prompted this call was my thoughts about us thinking about going into Iran or any of the surrounding areas. I would like your opinion. Do you think that George W. Bush has gone so far in his religious zeal that he has replaced, he's using Bush's jihad against Islam as a synonym for the war on terror, that he just uses those things interchangeably?
I think there's a piece of that, Patty. I really do. George W. Bush and some of the people around him are serious believers in this whole left behind thing. I mean, actually, you know, Tim LaHaye is a big Republican, big shot, the co-author of the series, and which are, by the way, the best selling books in the world right now, novels, fiction books, and the believing that if they can just get a war going on the plain of Armageddon in northern Israel, if they can just get this war going, then Jesus will come back. And the scary thing is that there's a Muslim equivalent of, or an Islamic equivalent of that belief, and Mr. Ahmadinejad subscribes to that. So you've got two guys who are both trying to bring about the end of the world because they think it's going to bring about some new incredible religious, spiritual awakening thing, change, whatever. And 1,000 years of peace, which let's keep in mind was the theme of the Third Reich, 1,000 years of peace. And I'm frankly concerned about it. Patty, thank you for the call and for raising the issue. It's something that I think we all need to pay attention to from time to time. Craig in San Jose, California. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I had a question about the war funding. We keep hearing, and Bernie said it again this morning, that, you know, we don't have the 60 votes to stop a filibuster. We don't have the 67 votes to override a veto. But it doesn't take any votes to not pass legislation.
That's correct.
Defund the war. So I asked my congressman about this, and he said that what Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are worried about is that there's about 40 seats in the House and another few in the Senate that the Democrats just barely won in 06 and which they would very possibly lose if they were accused of not supporting the troops. So one question is that not a legitimate concern?
Yeah, I think it is, and I understand that. It's one of the reasons that I haven't been beating the Democrats over the, you know, about the head and shoulders around this issue. On the other hand, on the filibuster, I was pleased to hear Bernie agree with me that Harry Reid should simply say, "You guys want a filibuster? We're going to let you have a filibuster.
Make them do it." Yeah. I have an idea for how we might solve this concern about the Democrats about losing control of the House and Senate, which we wouldn't want to go back to the Republicans. What if we just passed a separate bill, a very small funding bill, which would only fund things to protect the troops, like the armored vehicles to protect them from IEDs, which account for about 80% of the casualties in Iraq? Then they couldn't be accused of not supporting the troops, but we would effectively defund the rest of the war.
It's going to have to do with parliamentary procedure. It's going to have to do with how it all gets put together in Congress. And the reality is that if something is going to get passed, if it is going to make it to the floor, that there have to be Republicans and Democrats together working on it. And as a consequence of that, I suspect that
I have a hard time believing, though, that Republicans would vote against a bill to provide armored vehicles for the troops.
Yeah, actually, the $9 billion just got passed rather quietly. In fact, the only guy in the Senate who voted against it was Russ Feingold. That was essentially for that. It was, to provide emergency logistical support and ongoing things like that. So, it's an interesting position, Craig, and it'd be interesting to see if Congress was to take that direction. How this thing plays out, how this thing, this new war appropriation is going to play out is something that we all need to be keeping an eye on. Angel in Somerville, South Carolina. Hey, Angel.
Oh, yes. Hi. I had some discussions about the impact of agriculture on the environment and, vegetarian versus non-vegetarian, all that kind of thing. And we've been working in research on what we're calling the sustainable farm model.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want is a farm, and I know you're going to this green festival in Washington, D.C., so if you want, I can even email some information. But what we want to look at is a farm that you can get fuel, energy, and food out of, as well as pharmaceuticals and these type of things. The idea being is that you can feed, you can take a crop like corn or sweet potato, you take the carbohydrate, and you make ethanol out of it. The remaining proteins and fats can be used as animal food, or they're high enough quality they can also be used for human food.
Mm-hmm.
If you feed these to cattle or chickens, you can use anaerobic digestion to make the manure into methane or natural gas to heat and cool your homes. 900 dairy cows make enough methane in anaerobic digestion to heat and cool 600 homes, 1.5 cows per household. I mean, we can get out of fossil fuels entirely by taking this type of approach.
Just with copper. it's interesting that when I first traveled around India, people heat with cow poop. They burn it, and you're suggesting we could use the methane.
Right, and what you do after the anaerobic digestion, you don't smell it. I've been next to one of these digesters, about the height of a home. Doesn't smell like anything.
Yeah.
The leftover material after you take the methane off for energy is fertilizer. It's organic fertilizer. The manure has now been broken down into the phosphorus and the nitrogen can be put back on the field, grow a new crop.
Yeah.
So we can also get away from runoff problems and nitrogen that's being made now with natural gas and fossil fuels. It's a sustainable farm. It's sustainable. It's something we can use throughout the world, this model, not just in the United States. And the problem is getting funding to work on it.
Yeah. Well, and also, one of the most, the other problem is what are the crops that most efficiently convert sunlight into biomass? And arguably the most efficient converter of sunlight into biomass is hemp, which is why the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were written on hemp paper.
No, we've got better crops here in the South.
You do?
We can get, about 25 tons of dry matter per acre with sweet potato right now. Molasses sorghum, sweet sorghum is unbelievable. And you don't have to give them much water. They're very nitrogen efficient. Kudzu. Kudzu has a lot of potential here in the South.
Yeah, and it's all over.
It can make roots that are like, full of starch.
Yeah.
Now, hemp and those kind of crops that have cellulose should be used to make plastics. And even DuPont is working on moving away from petroleum-based polyesters and nylons and these type of things. Instead of making them from petroleum, you can make them from cellulose, from hemp or canaf or trees or, you know, and that's really where those cellulosic crops can actually replace plastics. What if we replaced all the plastics that we use with plant-based plastics?
Now, what about the concern?
Think how much carbon we tie up out of the air.
No, absolutely. But what about the concern, Angel, that as we move into a fuel system, a fuel economy that's based on what we're growing, that the price of food is going to go up to the point that starvation around the world is going to increase?
See, that's the talking point from the American Petroleum Institute. That is absolutely untrue, because what you use to make the fuel out of is only the carbohydrate. And we have, in other words, the starch and sugar. We have an excess of that. We're fat in America and even in Mexico because our diets are primarily carbohydrate. What is remaining after you take off the carbohydrate are the proteins, the vitamins, the nutrients. We would suddenly have very high-quality protein, say, from sweet potato, for example. It's the same as egg protein. We would concentrate that protein. We could use it for supplements, for baby formula, just like you do soy protein. And we'd have an excess of it because we'd be growing these fuel farms on the 40 million acres that we're not farming under Reagan's Freedom to Farm Act.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we'd be taking all that CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a great idea. Angel, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on it. It's much appreciated. Interesting. Rich in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call. Two things. You were talking about the tax thing earlier. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when an income tax was instituted, didn't the Supreme Court say you can't tax labor?
No, actually, the first time that an income tax was passed in the United States was in the 1860s by Abraham Lincoln to help fund the Civil War. And then in the second time was in 1913, as I recall, wasn't it? Or thereabouts, or maybe it was 1918. It was, I think that the justification was World War One, but I'm sorry, I'm not that much of a scholar of it, but I don't believe that it has ever been said. I know there are people who argue that, but I don't think that there's any, you know, serious basis for it that you can't tax labor in the United States. And certainly we've been doing it for a long, long time. 45 minutes. And it's not so much taxing labor, it's taxing income. Taxing the income from labor. What the Bushies are suggesting is that you can't tax income from capital. That's really wrong. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Country. Now play something country.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. TalkRadioNews.com on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
How you doing today? What's up?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Well, let's see what's up. I was actually at my first White House press briefing in about 10 weeks, and my first under Dana Perino as the new White House press secretary, so that was very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire, it was very interesting. I don't even know if the word Iraq was mentioned. You would have thought that only domestic policy was at play in this country. It was really quite interesting.
Really?
Well, climate change was talked about, but the S-CHIP program was the big issue, really, and the threat of a veto to that was a big issue. The climate change obviously did come up because the president spoke today at the conference that the U.S. is hosting. He was at the State Department this morning and said that we take this issue seriously.
Yeah, he said he's pulling together the world's largest polluters and asking them to come up with a solution.
That's right.
Right. Let's get the world's largest heroin dealers and ask them to deal with the drug problem.
Yeah. That's basically what he said.
Yeah, let's get the tobacco companies together and help them figure out how to stop people from being addicted to tobacco.
Yes, one person earlier in the week described the idea of having voluntary voluntary limits, as would be the same as having voluntary speed limits. So this is really what we're suggesting here.
Let's get all the murderers together in the United States and ask them to solve the problem of murder. Maybe we could get a coalition of rapists out of Washington, D.C. to come up with a problem of rape in Washington, D.C. I mean, this is crazy.
His feeling is that unless we get these countries involved, that if we leave them out, then we're just not going to get anywhere, that we have to get them involved and engaged in the issue.
They're members of the United Nations. I mean, and most of them are signatories of the Kyoto Accord. Instead of just going to the countries that are the big polluters and saying, okay, you guys, let's figure this thing. I'm aghast. this is what Bush did in Texas, you know. He did the voluntary, when he became governor, he changed the rules for pollution in Texas to make it voluntary and to try essentially a cap and trade system. And as a consequence of that, Texas became the most polluted state in the United States. Pollution went up so dramatically in Texas during his tenure as governor. There's an entire book about it that came out just before the 2000 election, as I recall. And it had the word toxic in it, something like, you know, toxic Texas or something. The history of George Bush's environmental legacy in Texas. It was just a disaster. And nobody ever talks about this stuff anymore, but and now he's trying to do it to the world. It's amazing.
He says that by working together, we will set wise and effective policies.
Yeah, that's like asking my cat Higgins to come up with mouse policy, you know.
I love feeding you these lines. I can do another one now. He says, I want to get the job done. We have identified a problem. Let's go solve it together.
Yeah, that's... that's the kind of language that you would like to have coming out of a president. The problem is that we just know this guy is so disingenuous and that he's going to organize it in a way that is designed to stall, and it's going to be, you know, James Imhoff is somehow going to be involved in it. And I'm sorry, I'm totally skeptical and not impressed. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Could a coalition of the world's biggest heroin dealers deal with the problem of heroin? Maybe.
Well, yes, in fact, they could. They're extremely well qualified to do so.
Certainly.
As a matter of fact, if they put their minds to it, which when one looks at where is the profit margin in heroin, is it in eliminating heroin or is it in profiting from the sale of heroin?
Yeah. Well, actually, it may well be in limiting it. I mean, the war on drugs has certainly made a lot of millionaires and a lot. I don't know if it's made any billionaires. Probably has, but it certainly made a lot of millionaires all around the world. It, just like Prohibition made, you know, you had a number of. It made Joe Kennedy a millionaire.
Yeah, he didn't do too badly out of it, did he?
Yeah, among others. Anyhow, what else is going on?
Well, that was one issue. Another thing, just as an aside, is that the big Middle East peace conference coming up in November is going to take place in Annapolis, because Camp David has connotations, and there's never been a peace conference in Annapolis. It's also close to the Naval Academy, which is where it will actually probably be held.
So they're going to have the peace conference at the War College?
Well, not actually at the War College. It's not actually at the War College itself, but, you know, sort of in the vicinity of.
My head is spinning again.
It's not going to be quite up as down.
Yeah, I guess it makes a little more sense.
It does make a little more sense. It's a pretty town, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to happen. But then the S-chip thing, meantime, the veto looks like it's on. There are a lot of questions asked about this, about whether the veto could be sustained. I asked a question about whether, you see, at the moment, there's a requirement that states have to show that they've enrolled at least 95% of children with family incomes below 200% of the poverty level before they can extend the limit to 250%. And I asked the question, isn't to prove that you've enrolled 95% of children an unreachable goal?
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't the level been set so high by the Bush administration that it is almost deliberately unattainable, I asked?
And the answer was?
Well, basically the answer, she didn't use the word no, but she basically said that, you know, that their goal was to get children covered.
Interesting. Then why is he going to veto the thing?
Well, because the way that this thing is set up at the moment, it's you know, socialized medicine.
Yeah, he's going to veto it because it covers too many children. But their goal is to get children covered.
Exactly.
There's been a thread, have you noticed, Victoria, running through our entire conversation
here.
Do
you not feel a little bit Alice through the Looking Glass-ish?
This is, yeah, it is, or Catch-22-ish, or George Orwell-ish, or something. It's just, but I guess this is Republicans.
It is a little strange. Then on Rush Limbaugh's remarks about phony soldiers.
Yes.
She was asked about that. Now, she had not heard the remark or seen anything published about the remark, but she said that that was not a phrase that the president would have used.
Gee, what a surprise. But he's not going to condemn it the way the Senate condemned MoveOn.org.
She didn't go as far as to use the word condemn.
Yeah, what a surprise there, too. Interesting. Thank you very much, Victoria Jones.
You're very welcome. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Great talking with you. The Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. We'll be back with your calls and more news of the day right after this. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Anything goes Friday, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com to participate in our blog, 6 minutes past the hour. Media Matters pointing out that this is not the first time that Rush Limbaugh has called a Vietnam veteran a phony. He had referred to John Kerry's military service as a fraud and, quote, a total phony, back when the Swift boat attacks were underway. So, interesting stuff. Brooke in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Brooke, what's up?
Oh, hi.
You are on the air.
It's a first-time caller. You know, I'm calling because I'm feeling like, the Democrats are going to be facing a really uphill battle with getting the vote out. I feel I am a base voter for the Democrat Party, especially someone like Hillary Clinton. And when she goes and votes for the amendment that she did,
the Lieberman-Kyle amendment that said let's go after Iran.
I wrote her campaign this morning and told her that I wouldn't be giving her my vote even if she did win the primary. it's very disheartening, and I feel, you know, and I hear a lot of betrayal in the voices of my friends that I speak to about this. You know, are they throwing us on the trash heap and just going after the Republican voters or what?
Yeah, I think that what Hillary Clinton is doing is she's not running a primary campaign right now. She's running a general election campaign. She thinks, I believe that she and her advisors think that the primary is probably hers. And so she's playing to the center, not to her base. And the danger in that, and that there's a substantial danger, and the Republicans understand this well, and that is that if you leave your base behind, you got nothing. And because the center isn't enough. You've got to have the base and then build from the base. And I think that she's pursuing a strategy that is frankly dangerous. But, you know, I'm not a political consultant, and I may well be wrong. And time will tell. We'll see. You're welcome, Brooke. I think the assumption, though, there in the Clinton camp is that we'll all vote for her no matter what, and if she becomes the nominee, and therefore, you know, it has to go ahead. Now, the thing, and oddly enough, that might not be such a terrible thing. And here's why. And with all the caveats that I've put as the preface to that, here's why. Franklin Roosevelt, when he was running for president in 1932, his first election, as the country was in the depths of the Great Depression, or in the certainly, you know, well into the second year of it, I mean, you know, moving terrible, terrible times, and Herbert Hoover, the Republican president who brought us the Republican Great Depression, was running on a platform of prosperity's just around the corner, just like Bush with the Iraq War, right? Just a little while, or sort of Tom Friedman, you know, just another 6 months, everything will be fine. And Franklin Roosevelt did not run to his base, as it were. He didn't run a campaign based on his base. he ran a campaign based on the general public that said, yeah, you know, we're not going to go fascist. We're not going to go socialist. We're not going to make radical changes. We're going to step by step dig ourselves out of this hole that Hoover dug us into. And it was a successful campaign. It worked for him. And then once he became president and had the power of the presidency and the bully pulpit of the presidency, he was able to move ahead.